You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
The goal of the Israeli government is abundantly clear as we continue to witness the destruction of Palestinians in Gaza.
In my opinion, you are hurting Australia very much right now.
We have to talk about this incredibly destructive movement of left-wing extremism.
You have no idea what you just have unleashed across this entire country.
Welcome to World News Weekly. I'm Claudia Farhart in Bangkok.
And I'm Aaron Fernandez in New Delhi.
Aaron, did you see the clip of Donald Trump telling off John Lyons?
I most certainly did, Claudia, and it was some uncomfortable viewing for me as an Australian journalist. But for anyone who missed it, ABC journo John Lyons asked Donald Trump whether it was appropriate for a president to be engaged in so much business activity. He was then treated to one of those trademark dressing downs from the US president, all caught on camera, of course.
Yeah, Trump accused him of hurting Australia and basically threatened to dob him into Anthony Albanese when they meet next week. Had a real going-to-tell-the-teacher-on-you vibe.
Yes, it did. It was a stern telling off. Now, Trump's arrived in the UK for his state visit. We will be chatting soon with our chief international correspondent, Ben Lewis, about that one, plus more Russian drones reported over NATO territory.
Yeah, this week we've also got a major UN report accusing Israel of genocide as Israeli ground forces move in to seize Gaza City. We'll be chatting about the fallout from the killing of Charlie Kirk in the US, and former Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro is sentenced to 27 years jail.
This was the second state visit, and that's the first, and maybe that's going to be the last time. I hope it is, actually. But this is truly one of the highest honors of my life.
So we have all the pomp and ceremony of a state visit to look forward to now as Trump is in the UK to get one of his favorite things, FaceTime with the King and Queen.
It hasn't fully kicked off yet as we speak. He is still getting his beauty sleep before his big day out, but he's expected at Windsor Castle shortly. There already is our chief international correspondent, Ben Lewis. Ben, this is a rare second state visit for Trump. Is it going to be as big and controversial as the first?
Yes and no, Aaron. So is it going to be as big? Well, it's going to be the largest state visit in terms of military numbers and sort of the procession you see that has ever happened in the UK, apparently, which is something that Trump has been boasting about. However, it is all quite strategically happening behind the walls of Windsor Castle. Now, normally for a state visit, you would have the visiting leader, you know, outside Buckingham Palace going up the Mall, tens of thousands of people coming to cheer him or her on. That's not the case this time. That's partly due to security reasons, partly due to the fact that Buckingham Palace is currently being refurbished, which is very convenient, and partly because the British government really doesn't want the US president to see any of the protests that are expected. When he came here for his first state visit about 6 years ago now, there were enormous demonstrations. You might remember that the Trump baby blimp became quite infamous. It clearly got under his skin. That's in a museum now, so it won't be reappearing this time, we're told. There will be protests today, but probably on a smaller scale. It seems many Brits are simply taking the attitude of, look, we don't really like this guy, but we understand that he's a bit obsessed with our royal family, and if that helps Britain in some way, fantastic.
And Ben, I'm sure the UK Prime Minister will be hoping that all this royal schmoozing will soften Trump up for some favourable deals. But if he was hoping to massage down the tariffs, it sounds like he's already been disappointed.
Yeah, so the UK, it has to be said, already had a pretty good deal compared to the rest of the world. It's got a 10% baseline tariff compared to a little bit higher for the EU and other European countries. So the UK was already doing pretty well. What they wanted to do was get rid of tariffs on British steel completely being sold into the US. Now, the Americans have said just before this trip began, look, that's not going to happen. The Brits have gone, you know what, we'll keep working on it. You know, Rome wasn't built in a day. We already have a pretty good agreement as it currently is. The big benefit for Britain on this trip comes in terms of investment. A lot of tech companies, from the United States are joining the president on this state visit. And Microsoft has already announced a $30 billion investment in the UK's AI industry. So this trip has already paid off. Keir Starmer somehow has a pretty good relationship with Donald Trump, even though the two men couldn't be more different. It's hard to think of two world leaders who are more different in terms of style, substance and background. They do seem to get on. So the hope is there'll be more of these sorts of deals announced over the next 48 hours.
Now, Ben, another awkward name that is likely to come up during this visit is Peter Mandelson, the recently fired UK ambassador to the US and once a good mate of Jeffrey Epstein, the convicted pedophile. Is that the only potential road bump for Donald Trump on this trip?
Look, it is one of many potential road bumps, as is always the case when Donald Trump goes international. But this Epstein connection is still causing him huge problems back in the United States. He would have been hoping for a break from it coming here. It doesn't look like he's going to get one. So Peter Mandelson, the former British ambassador to the US, was fired last week. It was known that he had been friends with Jeffrey Epstein back in the day, but it recently came out that he continued to support Epstein even after he was charged with child sex offences. So Keir Starmer sacked him, insisted he would not have appointed him to the role if he knew if he knew exactly the depths of the relationship with Epstein. Of course, Trump's connections with Epstein are still a hot topic of discussion. And as he arrived in the UK yesterday, a group of anti-Trump activists projected images of Epstein and Trump on the walls of Windsor Castle. Now, four people were arrested for that little stunt, but it did get a lot of attention. And interestingly, of course, one of Jeffrey Epstein's other great mates, Prince Andrew, still lives on the Windsor estate. Now, he's no longer a working royal. He's not going to be invited to the state dinner. Still, there are far too many connections to Jeffrey Epstein for Donald Trump's liking. And I have no doubt that when he holds a press conference in Chequers on Thursday, that topic will come up for discussion.
Ben, we're told the king is waiting for you, so we'll let you go. That is our chief international correspondent, Ben Lewis, in Windsor.
Thanks, guys. I'll put in a good word. Next time you're over here, pop in and you can have crumpets with the queen.
Stay royal, Ben. Thank you.
Not a million miles from Windsor, President Putin has made a rare appearance in military fatigues on a battlefield, or a mock one at least, in Belarus, where thousands of Russian and Belarusian troops have been doing drills. The last time they did this was just before Russia's full-scale invasion of Belarus's neighbour, Ukraine. It's the culmination of what I imagine Vladimir Putin considers to be a pretty good week. The war drills were advertised as training to combat a NATO invasion. Zapad, the codename of the exercises, means West. But they have also served as a pretty clear warning as well.
Well, if you call repeatedly sending armed drones first over Poland and then Romania, as well as watching NATO desperately try and keep Trump on message, then yes, he probably would see it as a success, but it has also been a gamble, one that many EU countries have been warning about for some time, that Putin would test NATO. And I think the alliance is generally considered to have passed the test, for now at least.
Yeah, NATO fighter jets were scrambled and shot down, the 15-odd drones well inside Poland that were part of a massive attack on Ukraine. One took off the roof of a house, although Poland later said that could have been one of its own rockets. Russia said it was simply a mistake, but I'm not sure how much anyone believes that. After all, one drone is a mistake, maybe two is careless, but 15... And to add insult to injury, a couple of days later, another was tracked going into Romanian airspace. If you add all the hypersonic rocket launches and the nuclear-capable rocket fired from Kaliningrad, Russia's enclave within Europe, then it kind of just adds weight to this idea that it's all designed to intimidate Europe.
Very much so. And the US, however, may be taking a different message away from the week. Something that may well have annoyed the White House is that one of the countries which sent contingents of soldiers to participate was India, which said their 60-odd officers were there to foster greater cooperation with Russia. But the US did have their own people there too, in the form of two military observers, which can't have settled European allies' nerves very much regarding Donald Trump's willingness to take a hard line with Moscow, particularly after the US president said the drone incursion may have simply been a mistake. Now, what could be causing Putin some anxiety, however, is that the drone incursions have sparked discussions in Europe about tackling Russian drones over Ukraine and not waiting until they make it to NATO territory, something long wanted by President Zelensky. Moscow has said that would be tantamount to NATO being at war with Russia, but given the Kremlin has already said that they are at war, perhaps Europe may feel less worried about the consequences.
That was the sound of Israel's long-threatened ground operation aimed at taking control of Gaza City, apparently beginning in earnest. It started in the early hours of Tuesday morning with intense airstrikes as Israeli troops began pushing into the city. Residents described it as a night of hell. They say entire residential blocks were flattened, many of them as people slept inside. In the first 24 hours, the death toll reported by Gaza's health officials had already reached 93. The Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz declaring on X that Gaza is burning.
Israel says this is the last major stronghold of Hamas, with military officials estimating between 2 and 3,000 fighters remain in the city. The number of civilians there is believed to be more than 500,000 after about 350,000 moved south in the weeks leading up to this operation. Thousands more families were seen trying to flee in the middle of the night, but many say they have no money and no means to make it south. And Claudia, once again, we saw world leaders rush to condemn this, but it seems to have had little effect.
Yeah, almost immediately as this began, Aaron, we saw nations that have long been friends to Israel urging Benjamin Netanyahu to change course here. The UK's new Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, called it utterly reckless and appalling. And Australia's Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, also made a lengthy statement. She said the Netanyahu government is more isolated than ever. On that point, Aaron, on the same day this ground operation was beginning, the UN's Commission of Inquiry on the occupied Palestinian territories released a report declaring Israel has committed genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. It says there are reasonable grounds to conclude that at least four of the five genocidal acts, as outlined by international law, have been carried out, and that Israeli authorities have, and this is quoting their report, intended to kill as many Palestinians as possible. Israel has, of course, rejected that report in full. This was an investigation 2 years in the making, Aaron. It seemed to be a coincidence that its findings were handed down as this ground operation was beginning, but it only added to this sort of chorus of criticism.
Now, Claudia, we should mention that these are independent investigators and their report has no legally binding implications. But another thing that was happening as the tanks rolled into Gaza City was the US Secretary of State's visit. Marco Rubio was in Israel showing a united front with Benjamin Netanyahu. Senior Israeli officials told local and US media that the Trump administration supports this operation, but it wants to see it over as quickly as possible. After he left Israel, Rubio traveled on to Doha, likely in an effort to try and patch things up with the Qataris after last week's Israeli airstrikes on their capital. He spent 3 hours in the country. His meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu alone lasted longer than that. Now, he seemed to be pushing for Qatar to resume its role as mediator between Israel and Hamas. He said he believes there's only a short window to get a deal done now that this Gaza City operation has begun. But the Qataris say their top priority is protecting their sovereignty and that after last week's attacks, all other matters are of secondary importance.
Yeah, and what was interesting about that meeting between Netanyahu and Rubio, they spoke for 3 hours and then they came out for a joint media appearance. And after all Donald Trump had to say last week about how he was very unhappy with what Israel had done, about how he had assured Qatar that this would never happen again, we then saw Benjamin Netanyahu standing right next to Trump's top diplomat and double down on his threats to continue targeting Hamas officials abroad, wherever they might be. So the US's stern words appear to have had very little effect there, Aaron. And neither did this emergency summit we saw in Doha this week. Qatar arranged a meeting of Arab and Muslim leaders to coordinate a response to last week's strikes. And in the lead up to that, there was all sorts of speculation about what kind of punitive measures they might take. Some leaders were even pushing for diplomatic ties with Israel to be downgraded as a result. But in the end, all they really came up with was a joint statement calling on all states to, quote, take all possible measures to prevent Israel from continuing its actions against the Palestinian people. That sort of stunned a lot of people. We'd just seen a massive escalation a week earlier, Israel bombing the country, trying to mediate an end to this war. And the outcome of this emergency summit was a statement that was really no different to any other statement that has been made over the past 2 years.
It is a vast domestic terror movement. And with God as my witness, we are going to use every resource we have at the Department of Justice, Homeland Security, and throughout this government to identify, disrupt, dismantle, and destroy these networks and make America safe again.
That was the White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller outlining the Trump administration's intentions to dismantle what he calls the radical left in the wake of conservative influencer Charlie Kirk's death. Miller made those comments while appearing on a special episode of Kirk's podcast, The Charlie Kirk Show, which was guest hosted by J.D. Vance from the White House earlier this week. The vice president used the platform to also decry the far left and what he says is its increased tolerance for violence.
Kirk was a key figure in US conservative politics, and he was largely credited with mobilizing young people to turn out for the Republican Party at the 2024 election. He was also a key ally of Vance and Donald Trump. He was shot while hosting an open debate at a Utah University campus last week. His suspected killer, 22-year-old Utah man Tyler Robinson, was arrested following a 33-hour manhunt.
Authorities are yet to determine the alleged assassin's motive, and his political leanings remain unclear. But that hasn't stopped the MAGA movement from placing blame squarely with the left. Key administration officials and Donald Trump himself have accused left-wing radicals of being responsible for Kirk's killing. Beyond the administration, many on the right have invoked declarations of war and retribution. Billionaire Elon Musk posted on X, "If they won't leave us in peace, then our choice is to fight or die."
Similar political assassinations in the States have previously been a moment for leaders to call for calm and unity, but it appears many in the magosphere are using Kirk's death to further stoke division in an already inflamed political environment. To unpack all of this further, we're joined by Dr. Emma Shortis, the Australia Institute's Director of International and Security Affairs. Emma, thanks for coming back on the pod.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Emma, let's start off with the killing of Charlie Kirk last week. The US is, of course, no stranger to political violence, but what do you think his killing and the reaction to it so far tells us about the current state of political division in the US?
I think you're right to point out, firstly, that political violence is really a feature and not a bug of the American political system. And so you know, it's quite jarring when you hear high profile figures, particularly in America, say that, you know, there's no place for this kind of violence in American democracy, because there clearly is. But I do think that Kirk's death is different, not necessarily because of the death itself, but because of the reaction to it, which you've outlined. You know, to have the President of the United States responding to a political assassination in this way, to give a video address from the Oval Office, effectively calling for retribution, not on the person who perpetrated this murder, but on a nebulous radical left, by which he effectively means and has always meant the Democratic Party, you know, not really radical or necessarily even left. So the difference there, I think, is in the reaction and Trump's very predictable efforts, I think, to weaponize this horrific incident.
How could this play out? Who could the White House go after, as J.D. Vance says, and what actions could they take?
I think this is the part where I would usually explain to you, you know, that it's not legal for Trump or the administration to go after independent funding bodies or organizations, you know, that he doesn't have the constitutional power to do that. But as we know, you know, as the Trump administration keeps telling us, they don't particularly care for the rules or norms of American democracy. And so what they've hinted at really is that they will go after the fundraising apparatus of nominally left organizations. Trump has singled out George Soros in particular. So it seems like they will, you know, through executive order or other means, go after the organizations in that way. But I think we also have to see those potential actions in the context of broader assaults on American democracy and efforts in particular to suppress dissent. So at the same time that this was happening, you know, that Trump and Vance are talking about going after the quote unquote radical left, the Trump administration is also sending the National Guard into Memphis and talking about sending the National Guard into Chicago, which again, as we know, is unconstitutional. And those are just a couple of the ways that they are suppressing dissent. So I think it's important to see all of this in that bigger context.
Yeah, we want to talk to you about that move to send troops into Memphis. Do you think this response to Charlie Kirk's killing is sort of adding to a pattern of what some are calling growing authoritarianism? And do you see a pathway to any kind of de-escalation here?
I mean, I think it's absolutely moves on the pathway towards authoritarianism. You know, these moves, this kind of suppression of dissent, is straight out of the authoritarian playbook. And you know, has long been a plan, I think, of Trump and the people around him, particularly Stephen Miller, who you opened with. So certainly, I think these are brazenly authoritarian moves. They're not hiding it. They're telling us exactly what they're going to do. Look, I think de-escalation is always possible. You know, I'm a historian, so I would argue that nothing is inevitable. But you know, the sticking point here is that Trump, the person in charge, is not the slightest bit interested in de-escalation. You know, he's interested in the opposite. He's interested in fostering division, in continuing to, I think, stoke that kind of violent, potentially violent repression. And that, I think, is a critical difference. You know, when we make the comparison to moments in American history, many people are talking about 1968, for example. The difference now is, I think, the leadership and the kind of power that Trump is amassing in the White House.
Emma, a lot going on, but always great to chat with you. Thanks so much for joining us on the pod once again.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Claudia, now to Brazil, where former President Jair Bolsonaro has been handed a 27-year jail sentence after being found guilty of attempting to stage a coup. Now, these charges relate to the 2022 general election, which Bolsonaro lost to the current president, Lula da Silva. A panel of federal Supreme Court judges has now found that Bolsonaro and seven others actively attempted to overthrow Brazil's democracy.
Yeah, 4 out of 5 justices on the panel voted to convict the now 70-year-old former president, finding his attempts to undermine that 2022 election began a year earlier when he started spreading misinformation about electronic voting. But it was really after his narrow election defeat in October 2022 that Bolsonaro's efforts to cling to power became much more serious. According to the court's ruling, he met with Brazil's top military leaders to gain their support for a coup and even hatched a plot to assassinate then president-elect Lula da Silva. Bolsonaro's election denialism led to a riot on January 8, 2023, when his supporters stormed the Supreme Court, the presidential palace, and the Congress in a failed attempt to stop Lula's inauguration. 7 of Bolsonaro's close allies were also convicted alongside him, including his former defense and justice ministers and his former spy chief. And ultimately, Bolsonaro's attempt to stage this takeover only failed because Brazil's army and air force chiefs refused to go along with it.
Bolsonaro and Donald Trump are close political allies, and there are a lot of similarities to Donald Trump's refusal to accept his own election defeat in 2020. Trump has labeled this investigation, much as he did his own, a witch hunt. And the White House has actively tried to stop the investigation into Bolsonaro, sanctioning the head judge, Justice Alexandre de Moraes, under the Magnitsky Act, usually used on dictators and their henchmen. And the US even announced 50% tariffs on some of Brazil's exports. Now, after Bolsonaro's sentence was announced, Marco Rubio said that the White House would respond accordingly. And the key question now is whether Bolsonaro will actually serve the full sentence. He's currently under house arrest. His lawyers say the 27 years and 3 months sentence is absurdly excessive and say they plan to appeal.
Yeah, and there's no indication so far that Bolsonaro will relinquish that influence he still has over Brazilian politics despite his conviction. His supporters in Congress, the legislative chamber of Brazil's parliament, are in the majority and they are trying to get an amnesty bill passed that's aimed at getting a reduced sentence for his supporters that took part in those January 2023 riots. But if it passes, it might help Bolsonaro himself as well. Okay, time for a quick look at some of the other major stories making headlines this week. Australia has suffered a setback as it tries to build military ties with countries in the Pacific and curb China's influence. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese was hoping to sign a mutual defence treaty with Papua New Guinea while he was in Port Moresby this week. But instead, the two countries signed only a defence communique.
The PM's office said Australia and PNG have agreed on the text of a mutual defence treaty, which will be signed following cabinet processes in both countries. PNG's Prime Minister James Marape said that Australia is PNG's security partner of choice, but he said there was still a process to run before a treaty can be signed. And he denied that China had pressured Papua New Guinea not to sign the agreement.
China and the Philippines have been facing off in the South China Sea this week. The Chinese Coast Guard firing water cannon at 10 Filipino ships it accused of making an illegal incursion into the Scarborough Shoal, which lies within Manila's exclusive economic zone. The Philippines says its ships were harassed by the Coast Guard vessels during a supply mission to support local fishermen.
Tensions flared again when Beijing announced plans to designate the shoal part of a nature reserve. China says this is all about preserving its coral reef ecosystem, but Manila is calling the move a clear pretext towards eventual occupation.
After protests led to the ousting of Nepal's government, the country now has its first female prime minister. 73-year-old Sushila Kaki was appointed interim leader after an agreement between Nepal's president, youth protesters, and civil society groups. Nepal saw widespread protests earlier this month, triggered by a government ban on social media, which many saw as a threat to freedom of speech.
A former Chief Justice herself, Sushila Karki, now faces several challenges as interim PM, including rebuilding the public's confidence in Nepal's democracy and rebuilding the buildings that were destroyed by protesters, including the Supreme Court and Parliament. Karki has promised that she will only be Nepal's Prime Minister for 6 months until a general election is held in March next year.
Albania has become the first country in the world to appoint a new minister made entirely out of artificial intelligence.
Mirëserdhët në Albania. Unë jam asistenti juaj virtual, I krijuar nga inteligjenca artificiale.
Simply named Diela and dressed in traditional Albanian attire, the AI bot was originally developed to help citizens navigate government services online. But she's now been given a promotion, Aaron, and she now heads up public procurement. The Prime Minister, Edi Rama, says Diela will help assess proposals made by private companies while keeping an eye out for signs of money laundering, drug trafficking or other illegal activities. So, what do you reckon, Aaron? Would you trust an AI public servant to be entirely uncorruptible?
For me, I'm just not sure whether the answer here shouldn't just be cracking down on these corrupt politicians rather than having this race to the bottom between corrupt politicians and an AI. But what do you think, Claudia, if we have one here in Australia, an AI minister, what do you think they should be called?
Funny you ask, Aaron, because I happen to have some spare time up my sleeve this week and I want to introduce you to a new friend of mine. Please meet Australia's first AI minister, Bruce.
G'day, I'm Bruce, your Minister for Public Procurement. I'll make sure contracts are fair dinkum, spotting rorts, cutting red tape and getting better bang for your buck. And I never knock off a smoko. Think government transparency that's clearer than a schooner glass on a Sunday arvo. You'll see where the dollars go. No more digging through paperwork thicker than your nan's fruitcake. And any funny business will be sniffed out faster than a kelpie at the sheepyards.
I wasn't expecting it to go on for that long.
You've won me over, Bruce. That sounds like an AI government minister and public representative that I can get behind.
Let's leave it at that. And let's leave the pod at that too, Aaron. That is The World This Week. If you're enjoying it so far, be sure to like and subscribe to World News Weekly. New episodes will drop every Thursday. See you next time, Aaron.